in 3, 2, 1. Hi, this is Tim Grierson.
And hi, this is Will Leach, and this is the Grierson and Leach Podcast, episode 25. This is a very special edition of the Grierson and Leach Podcast because I am in the same room as Grierson. How's it going, Tim?
I'm good. This
hey,
way you
high five. Hey, we're dorks.
We couldn't do that on a normal podcast.
No.
This week we can because
we're
Will's
right here.
In LA, yes,
I am in Grierson's house here in Los Angeles. I am out on the West Coast. This is our first ever of the 25 podcasts that we've done that we are together. Grierson, it's honestly good to see you.
Yes, you too. You look the same, which is good.
That's good. That's good. That's good. They reattached the arm. So. All right, so we have a lot to get to, so no more of these niceties, Grierson.
No more niceties.
Though we are in Grierson's office. I'd like to note, if you ever wondered what Grierson's office, he has four movie posters. Here are the four movie posters. There is Unknown White Male, Manhattan, Safe, and Shortcuts. Good movies all.
Yes, and the Unknown White Male one, the reason why I have it is because I am quoted on the poster, but it's attributed to Tom Grierson. And it was my first quote ever on a poster, and I was so happy with the typo that I actually asked them if I could have one of the typo posters. They fixed it later, but I said, no, I want one of the mess up, the yes. screw up one. So it has a place of honor in my home.
He is, in fact, the Unknown White Male of the title. So we have a lot of movies to get to this week because we have three reboots, and we thought we were only going to do one movie, The Secret Life of Pets, but because if you remember from last week's podcast, we did not actually get to the BFG. So we're going to talk. First off, we have to talk about, we remind you as always to please follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach, subscribe to us on iTunes, give us a nice review on iTunes, and give us the name of a movie. If you do that, we will talk about your movie in our reboot section. So first off, here are our three reboot movies. We will read your review on the air if we pick your movie, like I'm about to do so. The first movie comes to us from RavensFan40, or Jake in parentheses. Much love, 5 stars. Not a Woody Allen fan, but I love these two at work. Been reading them since the Yahoo days, and if they want to throw in a Miller's Crossing review sometime, that'd be cool. Well, guess what, pal? We are doing Miller's Crossing. That'll be one of our movies we're doing today. The second movie comes to us from Swishing Threes. Insightful as always by Leach is the subject, 5 stars. For a dude, bro, who started his career as a hellraiser at Deadspin, Leach has matured into one of his generation's most interesting, rational, trusted voice in sports, politics, and pop culture. Can't wait to hear one of the proudest members of the self-proclaimed greatest fans in baseball discuss whether Jim Norton was right to convince Patrice O'Neill that Face Off was not a bad movie. I don't know what that's referencing, but I'm sure that's probably a big Comedy World thing. But by the way, we're going to be talking about Face Off. And the last movie.
Finally.
At last. This comes from Matt Singer. Another great movie podcast, 5 stars. I rarely agree with these gentlemen, but that doesn't matter. They're smart, articulate, funny, and their conversations about movies are excellent. They've been friends for a very long time. That's pretty presumptuous. And that comes through in their reviews and their report on air. It's worth listening to if you're a fan of film discussion. Also, I'd like to hear their thoughts on the 1985 martial arts classic, Jim Cotta. Well, I'll have you know, life is short, but I and Grierson spent 90 minutes, that they claim that movie's 90 minutes, I would argue it's much longer, of our lives watching Jim Cotta. So those are our three reboot movies this week, but let's kick us off with the BFG.
What kind of a monster are you?
Bone cruncher. Coil chewer. Meat dripper, gizzard gulper, butcher boy.
Please don't eat me.
You think because I'm a giant that I'm a man goblin cannibal?
The BFG, which we did not get to last week, of course, is directed by Steven Spielberg, written by the late Melissa Madison, based on the Roald Dahl book, starring a computer-generated... Mark Rylance himself is not computer-generated.
He's a real person.
Yes, he's a real person. Ruby Barnhill and then Bill Hader. Rebecca Hall is a person. This movie's been out for a while now. I was going to say a bunch of people have seen it, but a bunch of people have not seen it because it's been one of the biggest failures, financially speaking, of Steven Spielberg's career. So this movie's been out for a while. We have not actually talked about it yet. So Grierson, what do you think of the BFG?
I like the BFG fine, but not more than that. For me, I saw this at Cannes, and when I saw it at Cannes, my immediate feeling while watching it was I had really liked his last two movies. I really liked Lincoln. I really liked Bridge of Spies. And the thing I liked about both of those movies specifically is they felt like, even in sort of the golden age or like the end of Spielberg's career, he was still pushing himself and doing different things. Whatever people think about Lincoln and or Bridge of Spies, I would argue that those are not movies you can look at and say, oh, well, he's done this thing four or five times. Both of those movies felt like he was really pushing himself and trying new things. And I think both of those movies benefited from the fact that they felt like they were things he didn't know comfortably. And he was really sort of testing himself. And that made part of the fun of watching it. The BFG, I think, is perfectly fine and perfectly charming and perfectly entertaining. But while watching it, I kept thinking, though he hasn't made this movie specifically before, it feels very much like a movie, whether or not this was his intention, that feels like, I'm Spielberg.
I can do this.
There's no problem.
Yeah.
For Spielberg, at this stage of his career, to do a movie that feels like one for them feels very odd. But it feels like a movie that's like, listen, if I make the BFG, can I do blah, blah, blah? I'm not saying that's actually what happened, but it feels like that type of movie that feels like, well, he did for the studios to make them happy. The fact that it's not this big hit is even more kind of ironic because of that. I think Mark Rylance is quite good as the BFG. I think that some of the imaginary world or the giant's world in this movie is rendered pretty impressively, but whether it's Legend of Tarzan or Jungle Book or this, I have to admit, I am getting tired of staring at worlds that are completely put or basically created in a computer. There is something about them while I watch them, I think there is nothing about this that feels real. And so there is no human stakes in terms of what I'm watching. It's perfectly fine, but it's not a movie I remember very fondly. And I saw it about 2 months ago.
Yeah, it's funny because I saw this about, I guess, 2 weeks ago. Obviously, we're doing the podcast a little later than we usually do on this one, but I had to remind myself of basic plot details, which is a major problem of BFG, is there's actually not a lot that happens. Like, the movie, I don't remember, even when Spielberg makes movies that I don't like, there's always an energy to them. There's always a fire to them. There's always, you know, I made the analogy in my review for The New Republic that he is like, I feel like that the old line about a pinch hitter in baseball, you can wake him up in the dead of winter and he'll hit you a line drive. Like, no matter what you do, give Spielberg a action sequence or he will find wit to it, he will find verve to it, he will find excitement for it. And I just don't see that here. Like, it really feels very sleepy, I have to say. It's a really kind of a drowsy movie. There's a lot of it that just, I mean, the first half of the movie, like, it's really not until they meet the Queen of England that the movie really picks up and gets going at all. They were just kind of, the relationship between Sophie and the BFG is they meet, they first don't really like each other, and then they like each other. And that's just it. And that's just the way that works. And it, because of that, there's not a lot of, it just doesn't have a lot of momentum. It doesn't have a lot of energy to it. And because of that, that makes the stuff that the E.T.-esque parts of this, I think that they're trying to conjure up the wonder, the whimsy, the your magic special happy dream place or whatever, the weak part of Spielberg. Not that E.T. is weak, but that kind of stuff that really frustrates us about Spielberg. There's a lot of that that takes a lot of air out of the movie. I agree. Rylance is really good. But I'm not sure that's the right take. I'm sure it's the right take on the BFG, to be entirely honest. He's not very prickly. Like, he's really just kind of whimsical and funny and charming, yes, but he's not very prickly at all. And the whole thing of that character is he's kind of cranky and he's kind of obnoxious. I'm not sure he even says, like, the funny malapropisms quite the right way. Not to be like, I'm a loyalist to the book, but the movie's, his performance is good, but it's definitely too twinkly. And I think that really, really hurts that first part of the movie. And again, it does pick up a little bit during the Queen sequences. But still, I'm not sure that that kind of comedy is, frankly, Spielberg's strength. Like, the thing I love about Spielberg, there's wit, even the things that aren't funny. Like, of course, the famous sequence of Jurassic Park, where, how confident of a filmmaker you have to be to the middle of a crazy, here's the T-Rex attacking, to cut to a fantastic joke about objects in the mirror being close in their appearance. Like, the confidence of the filmmaker you have to realize, I'm not going to lose him here. They're going to laugh, and then they're going to keep being really freaking scared. It's just, it doesn't look like his heart's in it for
that. Yeah, I mean, I think, and I know that other people have also complained about the fact that it feels very sleepy. I don't disagree with that. I do think the movie's saving grace is that, though the stakes are pretty darn low in this movie, there is a gentleness about this movie that I found redeeming enough. Because I agree that it's a movie that, like you were saying, the plot points don't really kind of carry you along. Yeah. And when she shows up, or when she's captured and brought into his world, there isn't really, even when there are other giants there that might attack her or eat her, you don't really feel
like there's not danger.
Yeah, it feels like a movie that you would take your kids to, and you would know this better than I would, of course, but it feels like a movie you take your kids to on a Saturday matinee. Yeah. It's not a movie that has a lot of stakes or drama, or even, frankly, there's not a lot of teachable moments, I feel like, in this movie. It's very much a, here's a orphan girl. She meets this basically lovable giant who's vaguely cranky.
Yeah, right.
Because I haven't read the book in a long time. I remember him being more that way in the book. And they have gentle adventures. And they see...
Their adventures are very gentle.
They're very gentle. And on that kind of low-key level, I think it works. But I agree that that's as high as that ceiling is for that movie.
And I think that really... You know, we'll wrap up with Grace after this, but we've talked about Spielberg. One of my favorite stretches of Spielberg, we've both talked about this, is that stretch where he's making like a movie or two a year and just flying through with Munich and Catch Me If You Can and Minority Report and My Favorite War of the Worlds. Like the movies that he was almost just flying through and almost, again, not to use the baseball analogy again, but like a hitter trusting his talent. And this feels like something that really he's just not into. And, you know, I obviously like Lincoln a lot. I like Bridge of Spies, but even in Bridge of Spies, I wrote this in my review, it felt like a little grandpa-y. Like, it felt like there's some good sequences. I think the opening sequence is really good in Bridge of Spies.
It's really tremendous.
But I think a lot of that feels like a, I'm going to make them like they don't make them anymore. And it feels a little stodgy. And I think it works for a movie like that because it's kind of old-fashioned anyway. Here, it just feels really sleepy.
Yeah, I like Bridge of Spies more than you do, but for me, that stretch, and we have talked about this, that stretch of when he was doing one after another, there was a level of him not worrying and just making stuff. And I think, because I actually rewatched part of Minority Report because it was on television, and I was once again just sort of blown away by parts of that movie that you would not know Spielberg had made.
Right, because
it doesn't feel like what, though he's made so many different movies, he continues to do different things where you go, oh, I can't believe he made a Lincoln. I can't believe he made a Bridge of Spies. BFG feels like somebody else trying to make
a Spielbergian kind
of film. It's I like it enough to recommend, but it's not one... there's no hill I'm going to die on for this.
So what'd you give it?
I gave it a very low B.
Yeah, I give it a C-. I have to say, I really just could not... It is definitely drowsy. Like, you realize... By the when there's no stakes and there's no energy... I feel like we're being nice to him. I feel like if this is by other filmmakers, we would be like, you're right, this is a pretty low-grade Spielberg homage.
Yeah.
So, all right, so that is the BFG. I didn't like it, Grierson liked it, and he has to die on that hill. All right, the next movie is The Secret Life of Pets.
I'm Max, and I'm the luckiest dog in New York because of her.
Come on, Max, I gotta go. See you tonight.
Bye, Gidget.
So long, Mel.
See you later, Chloe.
Morning, Max.
What's up, guys?
Any plans today?
I got big plans. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to wait for Katie to come back.
Oh, I miss her so much.
Let's talk about The Secret Life of Pets. It is directed by Chris Renaud and Yaro Cheney. It features the voices of Louis C.K., Kevin Hart, Jenny Slate, Eric Stone Street, and in a... Wait, that's Albert Brooks, right? Albert Brooks as a hawk. It is by the same company that gave us Despicable Me and gave us The Minions. And it's basically about, I mean, honestly, I think an argument could be made that a lot of the thought that went into this movie stopped with the title, which is, hey, what do pets do when we're away? And what are and therefore we meet Louis C.K. as this very cute... Is he a beagle? What kind of dog?
He's a terrier.
He's a terrier. Okay. He's a terrier, and he loves his owner, who's, what's her name, from The Office.
Ellie Kemper?
Yes. And his owner brings home a big dog, Eric Stone Street. They don't like each other. they get loose in New York City. All sorts of hijinks ensue.
It's like someone saw Toy Story. And
yes, literally every single other movie, every single other kids movie that way. And one of the things, I'll just kind of get into it on this. When I first heard of this movie, I got kind of excited because I'm a big fan of Ants. Now, listen, we're Woody Allen fans. This is a Woody Allen podcast. So obviously, well, you guys like Ants? Really? Yes, we like Ants.
Ants is very fun.
Yes, and I like Ants. I think I like Ants even a little bit more than you do. But one of the things I like about Ants, too, is it, and that got me excited about this, is Ants feels like, it's not obviously not a Woody Allen movie, but it's clear that it's steeped in a Woody Allen, in an old school, romantic, big city
right.
A sensibility. The movie even feels a little 70s with like its politics and Sylvester Stallone and Gene Hackman. And I always imagine the cast for that movie, how impossible it would be to get them to actually be in a movie as themselves. And I hope this would be, so it's steeped in Woody Allen's sensibility. I had a hope that this would be steeped in Louis C.K.'s sensibility because it's such a very unique and very specific sensibility. It is not. It is not his Ants. It is, I think he gives a perfectly fine vocal performance. And I think it's one of the better things about the movie. But, you know, it's strange. I joke about the whole premise being caught up in like the plot in the title of the movie. But it really kind of is. And what's strange of that is the idea of what do pets do when you're not there? Or toys do when you're not there? Or fish do when humans aren't there? Like when you're not looking, here's what's actually going on in that world. It's such a trope in kids' movies that this movie seems to find it unique and like it really never does anything with it. It's really just like the first 10 minutes is really the only time that the movie is really about the secret life of pets. There's your little jokes. And then they're off on this kind of dull adventure. They meet Kevin Hart, who is funny, I guess, as this rabbit who's a head of a crime syndicate or something. But the general thing with this movie is there's never a time in this movie where are they going to make the obvious joke? Yep, they're going to make the obvious joke. Where are they going to go with this? Yep, they're going to go in the most obvious way. It's not fair, really, to compare things always to Pixar. So, but it does feel kind of, generally kind of half-assed. And I really didn't like it very much.
Yeah, I, in my review for The New Republic, I opened by recalling several years ago when The Simpsons did a parody of Pixar called Condiments. I don't know if you remember this, where they go to watch a short called Condiments, and the whole premise of this, the company's called Mixar in this thing, but it's about like a bottle of ketchup and then like a mayonnaise jar, and they have to leave the house, and they're so scared. Right. And the joke was so obvious that was very much the Pixar model. This very much is, like you said so well, if pets went away or if pets were on their own, what would it be like? Yeah. And the answer is probably more interesting than what this would be if that was the case. I think Louis C.K. is so fun in the first 5 minutes. I had such hope because the thing I think...
That feels like it's going to be a little bit of his Ants.
Yeah.
For the first 5 minutes, it feels that way.
Yeah, because I think what starts it off and made me hopeful is that at the beginning, you get the sense of that Louis C.K. is slightly above the material and he knows it and we know that he knows it. But I just found myself being less and less and less interested as it went along. None of the characters are very interesting. Yeah. And that, you know, and I actually compared this to Pixar, and I even said, listen, it's so easy for critics to compare Pixar to other movies and to use Pixar as like this cudgel against them. But I'm sorry if you're not going to... Because even DreamWorks, I feel like, has looked at what Pixar has done and said, we got to step our game up.
Yeah, right.
The Illumination films, whether it's The Lorax or Despicable Me or like Minions, to me, they're so comfortably like middle brow, not interesting. I mean, I was in an all-media screening. A lot of kids responded to it, and that's fine. But I don't see why adults would want to be forced to watch this 100 times with kids. There's not a lot there beyond adorable pets. Right. For me, it's like I didn't get to the level of me hating it. But I thought, good God, is this movie long? And when is it over? And again, there's so many great animated movies out there now. And on this podcast, I have to bring this up. A couple weeks ago on the podcast, we had this whole debate about Finding Dory. You know, could an octopus actually drive a truck? This movie has so much of that type of stupid shit in there.
Absolutely.
Where it's like, and it's not even we couldn't even have a debate about it. It's just done so stupidly.
Yeah, yeah.
You can have that debate in a Pixar movie because Pixar has earned the
right
to be at a level of, of realism, but also in terms of creativity to go, well, is that really accurate or would that really make sense? In a movie like this, you kind of go, fine.
Yeah,
like, whatever. Like, this isn't their stupid thing you're doing. The Minion shirt before this movie is so terrible, and it has to be said. And again, this movie is just sort of like so disposable, but yeah. So what grade did you give it?
I gave it a C minus. I could not in good conscience give this any better than the BFG.
Yeah, I gave it a miss C. Yeah.
All right, that's enough. So in other words, so, you know, hey kids, if you like that movie this weekend, you're wrong and you're stupid.
From the makers of Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, a world where nothing is what it seems to be.
I want everybody to be friends. You, me, Leo, the Danes. All you gotta do to show you're a friend is give me Bernie Burn Bomb.
Tommy, you can't do this. You don't bump guys. It's not right, Tom. I can't.
The movie, of course, is Miller's Crossing, directed by the Coen brothers, Joel Coen. Not, yeah, that's back when they were...
Before they were allowed to have co-directing credits.
Yes. Exactly. So, of course, came out in 1990, starring Albert Finney and Gabriel Byrne. Lots of Gabriel Byrne on this podcast of late. John Polito, Marcia Gay Harden, John Turturro. And it's funny. First off, when was the last time you'd seen Miller's Crossing?
I couldn't even remember.
I have to say, I literally did not remember seeing. I know I had seen this movie at some point, but we're old. But usually I have like pretty vivid memories of I saw it at this. I did not remember seeing this movie. Played very new to me.
Yeah, this was the last time I saw it was at the New Beverly here in Los Angeles as a double feature with something else. And that was many, many, many years ago. And there was, for me, it was funny how much stuff felt new. But certain moments I went, oh, I completely remember this. I completely remember that.
And of course, the most iconic scene, the most famous iconic scene, of course, is when Gabriel Byrne takes John Turturro. That's what's on the poster. It's the movie. It's the scene they always give. I'm curious what you think, because you know, we've talked about Coen Brothers movies. We talked about Hail Caesar. We've talked, generally speaking, about Coen Brothers movies. I was kind of glad this was the one. I think this is the only Coen Brothers movie someone's asked us to do. I think
that's right.
So yeah. I'm actually kind of glad this one, because this is one I remembered less than the others. But it's really, there are people that think this is the Coen Brothers movie. Where do you put this in perspective of their career? Because a lot of stuff, it feels like early Coens is probably the best way to put it.
Yeah, and it feels very Barry Sonnenfeld.
Right.
Especially for Coen Brothers, like diehards, I know what I mean. Like, you know, because Sonnenfeld started off as their cinematographer and shot their first three movies. He didn't shoot Barton Fink, I don't believe.
Yeah, I don't think so.
It made me want to go back and watch some of their other ones to see where it landed. It is not, to me, top tier.
Yeah, I agree.
It is very good, but to me, looking back, and I hate sort of assigning, you know, motives to people, it was their third movie. This is the first one that feels like, wow, they're actually serious filmmakers.
Exactly.
And that is not to say that they, because I still think, if you put a gun to my head, and don't do that, Will, but if you did, I might still say Blood Simple is my favorite of their movies to this day. As much as I love Inside Llewyn Davis, and as much as I love that movie,
Blood Simple is surprising to me. I would have not thought that.
And that's why I'm really, because they're doing this restoration of it right now, and Blood Simple's playing across the country. I really want to see it, because I really love that movie, because there's something that's like perfect about that movie.
Wow, I'm surprised to hear you say that. I did not know that was your
favorite. I think that movie's pretty amazing. Miller's Crossing feels like them swinging for the fences in a way. It feels much more grand. Even the score by Kurt Burwell feels that way.
Yeah.
It feels as if it is aspiring to a level of art, which, as much as I like Blood Simple, as much as I like Raising Arizona, I think people will understand what I'm saying.
They're pulpier.
They're pulpier, and this one feels more as if there is more of an emotional, thematic depth to it.
Well, it's funny, because there are parts of this that we've just talked about, Road to Perdition, but there are times in this where I'm like, you guys are being a little bit more serious right now than you need to be. And like, one of the things my favorite scenes in this movie, I love John Polito in this movie, because he is pitched at like the Coen level. Like, it feels like he's funny, but he's also menacing, but he's also strange. Like, I actually feel like he's perfect. That feels like Barton going in the Barton Fink direction.
Whereas
Gabriel Byrne is more in the Road to Perdition direction, is probably the best way to put that.
Yeah, it's funny, because when we were at Deadspin, I wrote a piece inspired by Inside Llewyn Davis talking about how much I love those types of movies, specifically that one, A Serious Man, Barton Fink and the man who wasn't there. Right, right. I love those like male characters that they write who are kind of in this like weird existential quandary that they can't exactly get out of. And a couple of commenters said, well, what about Miller's Crossing? And it's funny because I don't feel like Miller's Crossing exactly, I don't think the Gabriel Byrne character falls into that, because partly, as opposed to those other movies and those other characters, Gabriel Byrne actually knows what he's doing.
Right, right.
And
right,
that's one of the things I think is great about this movie. Almost unique. Maybe there's one. You could almost make the argument that, frankly, the Brolin character in Hail Caesar is the closest to the guy who knows all the answers.
There's nothing bumbling. There's nothing bumbling about it. And usually even their heroes are bumbling.
Yeah, and in both those movies, the main character, there are people who are fools around them.
Right.
And some of them have more power than the main character. Right. But our hero, he knows the shot. He knows the angle. And so that's part of me is like the real fun of Miller's Crossing is that Gabriel Byrne knows what he's doing. And even there are a couple times where he doesn't think it's going to work out for him, there's this like calm about him that I really like. For me, what keeps it from being at the level of like my favorite of the Coens is that there is a bit of a cartoony level. Yeah. You were saying that
it goes back and forth a little bit. Yes. Like that's one of the problems with it. It goes like there's a little like that Sam Raimi, like he shows up in the movie, of course. There's a little bit of that Sam Raimi stuff in this, which I think is actually fine. Like that's Raising Arizona. That's definitely Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
But also there are times where it's very serious. I know we talked about this with Spielberg. It feels a little less confident.
It definitely feels like people who are trying something. And I think that's what's interesting about having a long, great career like the Coens have, is when Miller's Crossing comes out, critics could look at that and say, oh my God, I didn't know they were capable of this. We can look at this movie from 2016 and go, oh, you have no idea.
Yeah, look what like, they're going to be able to do next.
What they're going to be able to do next. Because I agree, this movie definitely feels like, let's try this. And a lot of it still works, and it's to their credit that a lot of it still works. But it's funny how it still feels like the training wheels are still kind of on in this movie. And of course, like, you know, famously, this movie took them so long to write that they would get stuck and they take a break and work on another thing, which would become Barton Fink.
And would turn them in this weirder direction.
Yeah. And I haven't seen Barton Fink in a long time. I think I still like Barton Fink better. Like, this is the type of movie you would maybe introduce people to the Coens if they'd never seen any. And then go, okay, this is really good.
You like this. Now go here.
Go check this out. And it's no knock on this movie to say they've made 6, 7, or 8 movies I think are better than this one.
I have to say, I'm still kind of stuck with the Blood Simple. I had no idea that Blood Simple was your favorite.
Yeah, it was funny because I was in New York recently and they were showing it in New York. It's going to be in LA next weekend here. I almost wanted to get over there because it really knocks my socks off. And it's so perfectly put together. So real fast, what's yours, would you say?
It's probably Inside Llewyn Davis or A Serious Man. So that is, so thank you, Jake. I believe it was Ravens fans, Jake or whoever that was, for giving us that one. That is Miller's Crossing. Now to number 2 of our reboots. The movie is Face Off.
Wait, you good looking. You're hot.
It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
Troy?
Now that is between us, okay?
But you were...
In a coma? Nothing like having your face cut off to disturb your sleep. Read the newspaper lately?
Face Off is from 1997, of course, starring John Travolta, Nicolas Cage, Nick Cassavetes, amusingly, Dominique Swain, Gina Gershon, Joan Allen, by the way.
Matt Ross, who is the director of Captain Fantastic, is also in this movie.
And also that guy that gets tortured in Reservoir Dogs that showed up in all of those 90s movies. He's the cameraman, the Natural Born Killers. I forget that guy's name, but he shows up in all of those like 90s. And it's funny, we'll talk about Face Off. I have to tell you, I've been a huge Face Off defender for years and years and years. I hadn't watched it probably in 5 or 6 years. I still love Face Off. I still love Face Off. Its ridiculousness is more obvious. And this is never a movie that felt like a taut Heat-esque crime thriller. But one of the things I really like, because it is so over the top and so like it's funny to think that now, because I think when we watched this movie before, to talk about the benefit of hindsight, Nicolas Cage in particular, Nicolas Cage, when we saw this movie, we're just like, wow, he's just this out there performance. He's really going all, and but now we're like, oh no, it's just Nicolas Cage going crazy performance. I still feel like this was still when he had a little bit more control over that instrument and was doing it with a little bit more purpose. But this movie's so over the top in the first place that it's hard to argue with it. I have to say, I kind of love that it takes this ridiculous premise and just never really questions it. It's just like, okay, they can replace faces. Okay, they're in this crazy futuristic prison where they have, that's on an ocean, that's on like a barge, right, in the middle of the ocean, and they're all, and they can't, there's magnetic feet, and okay, the brother is like weird Liam Gallagher, but I actually love Alessandro Nivola in this movie. I think he's actually
That to me was the big surprise of, oh, that's who that was. Yeah. The Liam Gallagher thing is well said, though. It's like, oh, it's like, yeah. And then he left to join like form Oasis after this. Yeah.
So I have to say, it is completely ridiculous. The ending is still kind of lame. There's so much buildup and so many of these great set pieces, and then the ending is a boat chase. It's like a little disappointing. But the thing I love the most about Face Off, it's crazy, but it's like legitimately fun crazy, and sometimes a little dangerous crazy. Like sometimes, like the scene I remember that I loved so much when I first saw it and like wiped me out again is when John Travolta, who of course is Castor Troy, sees his daughter, and there's this great moment where he's like, the plot thickens, and it's just like creepy and gross and awesome. It's funny. It's been 20 years, almost 20 years since this movie, and it seems impossible that this movie would exist today. The idea that you would trust these two big stars to have to go this far, to go over the top of it, to get into the weirdness of so much stuff in there. I absolutely had a blast watching Face Off.
This movie was both, for both of us, was in our top 10 yes. in 1996.
And we loved it then. So we loved it then.
I think
I love it for a different reason now, but I still love it.
Yeah, and we both, I remember us seeing it together the first time together, mm-hmm. and then seeing it, we went to a screening here in Los Angeles together, like mm-hmm. walked down and went, holy cow,
that was awesome, right?
And then saw it opening weekend, like 3 days later with friends of ours. I have to admit, I don't like it as much as
I don't like it as... I'll put it this way. I like it in a very different way than I like it.
To me, the 90s-ness of this movie is impossible to entirely shake from this movie. Right. And both in good ways and bad ways. I want to talk about the good way first. We talked about this before with BFG. It's really nice to watch an action movie where there are stunt people and there's not... I mean, there are effects, don't get me wrong. But I'm watching and I went, why are these action scenes working for me? I went, oh
the practical effects. Yeah. They're really happening.
Listen, there's this old argument, this constant argument of like, listen, they were doing all these safety things so people weren't really getting hurt. But there is an element of feeling of a tactile sense of... Even though the boat thing at the end doesn't work entirely,
right.
those are actual boats.
Right, being that are on fire, exploding. Right.
Yeah, they're being... And then like when the boats hit land and they fly, maybe it's not the two stars, there are human beings who
flying
are
flying through the air, right. They're clearly not the real stars, by the way.
Like, no, absolutely not. But still, there's
in an obvious way that now they would fix.
Yeah.
Right.
And even like the opening action sequence is really kind of terrific. Yeah. And that is something that I feel such a sense. I don't think, because I'm very anti-nostalgia, but I feel such a connection to that type of action sequence where I go, oh, there's like real stakes and danger what is... Because it's not just the sense of stakes and danger. It's a sense of putting people, whether it's stuntmen or the actors, into actual harm's way that makes you, at least for me, makes me appreciate the construction of an action sequence because I think that there are physical realities that have to be addressed.
And almost tamed.
And I think that really helps. And so... In terms of its 90s-ness, in terms of it, what I think is good, that is so... Yeah. Like, watching that stuff, I really enjoyed. Another thing, by the way, that you didn't mention in terms of things that don't make any sense. So, the John Travolta character, who's now Nicolas Cage, jumps off the thing and swims to shore, apparently. There's no question of how that happens. The Nicolas Cage element doesn't bother me, actually.
Yeah, I think he's great. I think
he's really good, because this was the... Post, he'd already done. This is like the same time as Con Air, or right after.
I think it's right after Con Air.
You know, it's closer to Con Air than The Rock, but this is when he's making the transition. He's won his Oscar and he's doing it. I think Nicolas Cage is great. I actually think John Travolta kind of stinks in this
movie. Yeah, see, I feel like he gets better when he's being inhabited by Castor Troy. I think at the beginning he's very, I'm very earnest action guy. Right. It doesn't really work. I think when he gets weirder and he's inhabited by Nicolas Cage in a lot of ways, I think it gets a little bit more interesting. I think his performance is better once that happened. But John Travolta is not good at earnest. Like, he's not good at, like, he's playing a very generic, boring hero for the first 20 minutes of that movie. It's not until I think he gets better once he's in heaven.
See, my issue with him as the movie goes along is that it becomes the badass, I'm making finger quotes, badass John Travolta performance that he's done since then in, like, really crappy action movie, like Luc Besson produced things, where it's, like, not even, because what's funny about his, like, career renaissance in the mid-90s, with Pulp Fiction, that character's not really a badass.
Yeah, Danny Stretch.
He's just sort of like...
He's schlumpy
and kind of a loser, but has like that Tarantino twist and angle to him. So when he started doing like more badass characters, it's like, well, actually, that's not why we're glad you're back. And so he works less well. Joan Allen, I had loved in this movie. I think she's good. She doesn't have a lot to do. And watching it this time, I thought... Yeah, she is kind of stuck. It made me wonder, you know, to your point about would this movie be made now, I'd be curious how they would address that character.
Right.
You know, in terms of...
Well, it would be a bigger deal, like, what she kind of goes through in the movie.
Yeah, there would be more sense. And I have to say that I liked John Woo's earlier films in his homeland better.
Yes.
And watching this now, I remembered why I didn't like his Mission Impossible. There was an element to me of...
Too many doves,
and also just too much, like, the operatic quality of the movie, I don't think entirely works. Right. You know, watching it now, though it's funny, I have to say, the one moment that still works for me, much to my surprise, is when Gina Gershon's character dies, and she tells him, like, don't let him turn out the way we are. It's such a thing that shouldn't work, but it feels, like, nicely grounded. Yeah. To me, this movie is very much, it feels like a time capsule piece. It was, to my dismay, did not hold up the way I was sort of hoping that it would.
And see, to me, I had an actual different experience. There's like some weird, funky little moments in this movie that feel like, and a lot of them come from Nicolas Cage, who really, like, I want to say that again. Like, he's so, he makes, that scene where he screams, I am Castor Troy, is just like awesome Nicolas Cage acting. Because it's just, it's all, like, it's conflicted and weird and over the top, but also, like, it steers into his skid a little bit in a really good way.
And I feel like, I think that as opposed to Travolta, I think he plays two different characters really convincingly, both of them. Yeah. I actually feel for that guy in the second half of the movie. Yeah. And I think that is entirely to Cage's credit that he was able to kind of do that.
Well, to me, one of the really, speaking of the Gina Gershon thing, one of the actual really effective moments of the movie is when she's like, what are we going to do about Archer? And he's like, one thing I can guarantee you will not have to worry about Sean Archer again. And there's like, it's like a nice little moment. Yes. Like, and that's something that he completely sells.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking before about, you know, just kind of going with the premise of this movie. I will always remember Roger Ebert's review of Star Trek IV. The humpback whale more commonly known. In his review, basically said, I would love to have been in the room where they came up with the idea for this movie and to see like the goofy grins on their face. Because that's another movie where it's like, that shouldn't work. Yeah. And they just all decided, let's just go for it.
Right.
And this movie, I think, again, to its credit, does kind of say, yeah, you can change faces and that's a thing.
Right.
I will say, though, I do feel like now this movie exists just for the great joke in Spy. When Jason Statham mentions, like, just give me the face-off room, because the other spies told him there's a face-off room. It's still good, but if I was redoing my top 10 list of 1997,
it would not make it this time. That's fair. But
face-off is good, but it's not great.
It's not your top 10. Okay. Well, nevertheless, I was very happy to watch it again. I really got a huge kick out of it, so thank you for recommending that to us. All right, Grierson. To the last one. Crack the knuckles. Stretch out.
I hope that this lives up to...
To all the hype of it.
Yeah.
It is Gymkhana.
His name? Kurt Thomas. His title? 3-time world gymnastics champion. His assignment? A secret mission for the United States government. His only weapon? Himself. And that's all he needs.
Gymkhana came out in 1985, directed by Robert Klaus, who I don't really remember what he did after this, starring gold medal winning gymnast Kurt Thomas and a bunch of other people. Grierson, I feel like a large, this of course comes to us from Matt Singer, who seemed to take the idea, as some people did, by the way, that were like, hey, we'll review whatever movie you want. The idea, like, oh, well, let's see if we'll make him sit through this, so on. So.
Though Matt is a huge fan of this movie.
He is. He likes it.
He is
it.
A huge, huge fan of this movie.
Yes, and, but, you know, this comes out, and listen, The Room is another movie that's on our list that we're going to have to get to at some point. But I think this, before we even get into the movie itself, I feel like we should talk a little bit about our general philosophy about movies like this. And, you know, which is to say, to boil it down to a very simple essence, it's a much more complicated conversation than this. But there are many, many great movies in the world that I have not seen. There are many great movies I have not seen in a long time. There are movies I love that I can watch over and over and over. And I'm eventually going to die. My minutes on this earth are short. They are limited. So to watch a movie that is purposely bad, to me, feels confounding and a bit of a waste of time. Now, I know a lot of people don't feel that way.
Right. And their argument, and I 100% agree with you, Will. Right. The argument against that is that these movies are not purposely bad.
Right.
They just ended up that way, and that is part of the fascination with them.
And there were moments when watching Gymkhana that there are those chuckles. I get that rueful, like, oh, wow, why is there a pommel horse in the middle of of all of these ninjas? And those sorts of things. But I joked about this in the intro. This is a 95-minute movie that I have to say felt to me like 4 hours long. And listen, it's obviously really bad and it's obviously very stupid. And there are a couple like little chuckles. You're like, oh man, this movie is really terrible. I have a hard time. And again, I know a lot of people don't feel this way. A very good, one of my favorite people in the world, Emma Spann, who is my old editor at Sports on Earth, works for Sports Illustrated. She hosts a weekly movie night of bad movies where she has friends come over and they watch terrible movies and they all have a blast. They drink wine. They have a great time. And there's nothing wrong with that. If that floats your boat, that is great. I just really had a hard time. Like, yes, it is really, really bad. It is baffling to me. Like, it's one of if there was anything fun about this movie, I would say that it was fun to imagine the mindset that initially came to its creation. The idea that, I don't know the backstory for it, but it does seem that like someone saw the gymnast, Kurt Thomas, and said, this is kind of like karate, maybe. Let's maybe see if we can have an action movie where this is a new American sort of martial arts thing. And of course, one of the many bad things about the movie is how, like, now there's a parallel bars that we're going to show up and kick people.
Yes, thankfully they show up at just the right moment.
Yes, is also might be the worst. If there's an award for worst sound, this might actually, like, not only are the thumps and the pows and the bangs really bad, there are times you literally can't hear the dialogue over the music. That happened like several times. And the worst part is I felt compelled to this project that we are doing to go back and re-listen and be like, did I miss something? Do I go along with that? So I understand there's a certain base appeal to. There are a couple times I'm like, okay, that's kind of funny because that's really bad and they don't know how really bad that is. I just can't imagine making a habit out of it.
Yeah, I can't either. I didn't hate this movie. I found it entertaining on the level of curiosity. And I think this is part of the appeal for these types of movies with certain people. The curiosity continued throughout the movie of why did anybody think this was the right way to do this scene, or to have this plot point be developed. I mean, I will say this, and I think it's worth mentioning. Of the three movies that we talked about on this podcast for the reboot, this is the only one of the three that two different people said to me, oh, are you going to do that? Oh, that movie is awesome. It's the only one that people actually said to me, unsolicited, oh man, I love that movie. It's such fun. The only thing that gets close to being like, oh my God, is the Village of the Damned sequence.
Right.
Just because of the fog that comes in and the weird people. There is a legitimately like, weird messed up vibe to that part. That's the only part of the movie where I actually was like, I wouldn't say riveted, that's not the right word, but kind of like, this actually feels unhinged in kind of an interesting way. The rest of it is just kind of incompetent. Characters talking and then boom, arrow hits them, and things like that. It's, and I love the political commentary in the movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
There's some really... It doesn't just like have action and romance. Mm. It also makes you think.
It does. And that is important. That is important. So Jim Khanna, no American anthem. No American anthem.
Yes.
No American anthem. So, all right, Grierson. So that is... So there, we made it through. I hope you're happy, singer. We talked about Jim Khanna in a much more serious way than I think anyone has ever talked about Jim Khanna. So.
I hope that our listeners appreciate the seriousness we bring to this project.
Yes, and the great humor that we have. This bad movie that you totally love and totally love to watch for bad movies. You're stupid for doing that. Yes. Please stop doing that.
Please think of us as the two killjoys.
Exactly. Yes. So, all right, Grierson. Well, this was I'm really glad we did this. If we'd done this in person, I have to say, I think you need to move to Athens and we can do this all the time.
I will say that this is the immediate thing I thought while doing this podcast is I'm going to have to make eye contact the entire
time. Yeah, it's
weird,
right.
It's a weird thing. Usually I'm just like staring at a wall thinking, when is he done talking so I can say something.
I'm usually playing like Words with Friends whenever you're talking, but not today. Today I had to pay attention.
Well, you are a smartie. It's true.
I am a smartie. So, all right. So next week, we will be back next week. Big week next week. Yes. Lots of big movies coming up next week. The two main movies that we'll be discussing, of course, Ghostbusters. You have seen Ghostbusters. I have not seen Ghostbusters.
Yes.
So Grierson will be writing about Ghostbusters for New Republic this week. So we're going to talk about Ghostbusters. So kind of a movie people are curious about. So.
And then the second movie, as we've discussed earlier in this podcast, we are excited to talk about.
Only we are the ones.
Perhaps other people are not as excited.
Yes, we will be talking about Woody Allen's Cafe Society, which I will be reviewing for the site this week. If you can look up our Woody Allen rankings. Woody Allen is, I think we've discussed Woody Allen enough. Well, it'll be good to talk about his new movie next week. And we have one reboot movie next week. Next week's reboot movie is Gattaca, starring Ethan Hawke, Uma Thurman, and Jude Law, right? Jude Law's in that.
I believe that's correct.
Yes, by Andrew Niccol, the writer of The Truman Show. And
I have never seen it, so I'm looking forward to finally having an excuse to check it out.
All right, Grierson, this has been episode 25. It was an absolute pleasure to get to do this with you in person.
This is a blast.
I'm very glad we got to do it. Honestly, let's just fly you out to Athens or fly me out to LA every week, and we'll just do it in person.
That sounds fine.
Or everyone, just give us the TV show. Give us the TV show, and I promise to wear pants for that. Have a great week, everyone. We'll talk to everyone next week. Grierson, good work.